You are listening to a Science Actually production.
I'm really happy you sold your sculpture, but don't you think it may have been a fluke?
Hey, I've always had an interest in art, dating back to my schoolgirl days when I painted portrait after portrait of Ringo Starr.
That's my life you're describing.
I think I remember my own life, Mark.
Please do this. We always hit record after the best banter is over.
That was a good little thing. I liked it.
It was a good little thing. And the listeners will never know what it was. Yeah. That's good.
I was talking about a toy. A fidget
spinner. We like toys.
I was talking about a fidget spinner that you can change the dimensions of, and my son didn't want it, and I fell in love with it madly because if you make it tight and compact, it spins super fast, and when you stretch it out rice nice and big, it goes slow and loses steam very quickly, and that's a science experiment, and my son just didn't care. So I kept it. And now I play with
him. He doesn't care about the conservation of angular momentum, and I am
he
sad.
He doesn't care about the conservation of angular momentum, and he should, as you should all.
Everybody should. Yeah, no, it's the key issue on everyone's minds. If you're a single-issue voter in this upcoming election, just remember to vote for the candidate who cares about conservation of angular momentum. That's it.
Okay. I'm voting solid, straight down the party ticket, the conservation of angular momentum party. That's where I'm going.
That's where you're going. Oh, you know what? I should remind you, Benjamin, we've been called out for our silliness. We have been told that our podcast by one viewer of our YouTube episodes has said that we are producing utter nonsense. So we have to produce less nonsense. Remember that.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
Yeah, sorry, first name, last name, random numbers. This is what you get. This is what you get. You get a nerd and you get a scientist. It's in the title. It's
right
it's,
there.
It's, see, shabooms. Shabooms, kabooms, shabalooms.
Oh, and we shouldn't say shabooms, kabooms. It might offend the person who thinks that we're being too silly.
Yeah. I mean, science is silly. Science is fun. I think that people have a lot of misconceptions about what a scientist should be, what is the correct behavior, the correct attitude. You picture us in the lab coats, which I never wear. You picture us in the glasses, which I've started wearing recently. Fine. But that's not the point. The point is that I think that there are a lot of different ways that science and scientific understanding can be conveyed to the public. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. We're going to be talking about science in art, art in science, and all of the various different crossovers between those two fields.
Right. Going back to the original cosmos with Carl Sagan, as we often do on this fine program of seriousness. There is a lot of discussion in that original Cosmos series and in the the later seasons with Neil deGrasse Tyson. We cannot see what the surface of other worlds is from being there. We've only sent rovers to a couple places here in our solar system, but not in other worlds. We can only guess and imagine. There's no surface that we know of on Jupiter, but we can imagine potential life drifting in the clouds. And the only way to help other people join the conversation and visually kind of have some sort of focal point is get an artist, give them some rules and tell them, you know, could you paint us a picture of a big, giant, floating balloon jellyfish type thing? And they'll do it. It helps give some sort of a visual, you know, a representation of what scientists are, you know, theorizing as a possible thing. It's not real. We don't know. But it helps fuel the imagination of what's possible.
I think it also creates a shared narrative, and mm-hmm. us humans love a shared narrative. You know, it's the best way for us to kind of communicate our ideas across space, across time, across cultures, and also in like a really succinct manner. Because if you think about it, so what you were just describing, like you said, a short sentence of words, and I knew what you were talking about. I had an idea in my mind of, you know, this balloon-shaped thing, right? But it doesn't matter that a planet is not literally a balloon. But when you are communicating things to the public or to other scientists, you don't want to start off by saying, well, it's a collection of rocks of various geological formations, and these are surrounded by a layer of mantle. And it's like, no, you need to start from the common ground, start from the most approachable and intuitive approximation. And then, where necessary, you add the details later.
Right. It helps people see possible, maybe, patterns. Scientists do a lot of research. You do insane amounts of research. And you gather lots of data from all the things that you study. And you could just show me a table of all your results, and that'd be fine, I guess. Or, as we discussed in the recent episode, the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, if you take all that information and you plot it according to some variables of information that you gather, all of a sudden you start to see this nice little flow of stars in that particular case. But there's also other types of ways that art can help, you know, show people science. But that's just one example. It's a beautiful thing. Art helps people. Art helps, what's a good way? Refine everything down to a few things. And then you just show those few things in context. And it's like, oh, yeah. Look at that.
Yeah. Some sense is a lot of, we have done the science. Yeah. A lot of the time when you're writing a science paper to submit to a journal, you have to think about the way that you want to convey a piece of information. And the best way to convey a lot of complex information, especially multivariable information, is in some cases to use a plot, a figure, an image, right? Where you can have multiple axes, X, Y, Z. You can have different colors, different shades. And you can, I mean, you know, it's a cliche, but like a picture really can say a lot more in a lot shorter or smaller amount of space than words can. So it's very useful for communicating science to non-scientists and also communicating science to other scientists. It's not right. It's not just a simplification.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what I was thinking about. Maybe we could share some like art installations that are here and there that lots of places have and that are based on science principles.
Yes.
And I had one in mind. Here in the United States, there's something called the Anthem Veterans Memorial in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And it is a beautiful art installation that, you know, helps honor all the armed forces of the United States. And it has a very cool sciencey thing that it does once a year. There are five progressively taller, huge monoliths, one representing each branch of the military. And in each one, there's this oddly carved oval at an angle tunnel going through them. Kind of odd. But it's done so specifically for a certain reason, because every November 11th at 11:11 a.m. on that day, every year, the sun shines perfectly through all five ovals, casting no shadow within them, and it illuminates a perfect circle on the ground. That is the seal of the United States of America. It's this wonderful thing. It's the one time they're all aligned on this one particular day. And I think it's, you know, I think it's beautiful. Just everything's lining up because somebody took time to see where is the sun going to be? How can I stand these up? How can I line them up? How thick do these monoliths have to be? How tall does each one have to be next to the other? Very, very clever.
I mean, that
science.
That concept alone, we could do a whole episode on, because I feel like humans have been making large kind of monoliths and structures like that that align with the sun or with the moon at particular times of year for hundreds, if not thousands of years. I mean, you can look at something like Stonehenge, you can look at, the Inca fortresses that were built, that, you know, these underground temples that they have that align with the light of the moon. And it's, you know, generally these things align with like the summer solstice or the winter solstice. And it's, there's so much planning, but they find a way to inspire people by using precise planning and measurements of the sun, of space, and you know, astronomical calculations. I love it. That's cool.
Yeah, that's what I love it. Never been there, but it's not too far.
Highly recommended. If you end up in Peru, you should definitely check out the Inca temples there that they have outside of Cusco.
That's it. I'm booking a ticket to Peru by way of Arizona so you can see these cool sun-powered, awesome exhibits.
Definitely, definitely. It's also cool seeing that there are more modern versions of this where there is art that is being created around things like space, things like mathematics. I mean, there are some incredible pieces that have been created by Catherine Machen and her brother Charles Machen. They both came from the world of visual arts and video game arts and design, and have ended up, that, you know, so Charles does these incredible visualizations that are based on mathematical renderings of you know, different equations or different physical systems. Catherine does these amazing galactic and interstellar scapes of just, you look at it and it feels just both hyper-realistic as a representation of space, but also just kind of like a touching piece of art that you look at it.
Yeah.
It gets,
I'm stunned that she can, Catherine's paint, first of all, they're all hand paintings that she makes that are hyper, hyper realistic paintings of all sorts of stellar phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And I don't get it. I just don't get how someone can make something so huge by hand, so specifically accurate, and it's beautiful. And she posts all of her artwork online. She also posts lots of photos and sometimes videos of her process making the artwork.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite is her standing next to completed artworks, and they're bigger than her. They're huge. And the time something like that takes, and to get when she does, like, I've seen artists when they paint space scenes or whatever, when they want to get stars in the background, they just dip their fingers in some white paint and flick it on and it looks good. But she takes the time to make sure every background star is accurate, not just by their placement, but by their brightness. And it's insanity. It's so well done.
There was, I'm fortunate enough to have two of her art pieces at home. One of the Sombrero Galaxy, which is hyper realistic, and it's just, oh my gosh, every time I look at it. And the other one is a collaboration that she was doing with Sophia Gadnasa, who's an astroparticle physicist. Mm-hmm. And this collaboration was basically, how can we visualize this thing that scientists can't actually see directly? And it was the interaction between kind of like these two black holes and their dark matter halos, if I'm remembering correctly. And so what you're seeing are these two kind of gaseous clouds of plasma and energy interacting with one another, and it represents physical reality. It's based on simulations that Sophia herself had run, and collaborating between the two of them, they brought this scientific story to life, which I just think is incredible. It's a very special talent to be able to do that.
It's amazing just how wildly colorful and creative something can look when, I don't want to say what, I don't say they're not being creative because they're following data, but they're adding creative flair within the certain guidelines of what scientific research has provided. And in doing so, beautiful art. And you have two of them.
I mean, the math itself is beautiful sometimes. Like, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Mandelbrot set.
Dude, I love the Mandelbrot set.
Bro, but have you heard about the Mandelbrot set in a complex plane of complex numbers? Dude,
I went to a pizza place just yesterday. I said, dude, give me the Mandelbrot set. And you know what? They gave me a weird pepperoni sausage pizza.
The pepperoni Mandelbrot set. It's for people who aren't familiar, the Mandelbrot set is like
not a pizza.
not a pizza. Okay, so complex numbers are basically a combination of real and imaginary numbers. Real numbers are the numbers that we know and love. Imaginary numbers are numbers that are related to the square root of -1. Right. And basically what we see in science, across things like waves and optics and quantum mechanics, the best way to describe certain physical realities is to use a function that has a real part and an imaginary part. So the whole function, the whole mathematical description of a physical reality is a complex number. And then when you want to figure out the real part of it, you just do some math and you get the real part of it. Anyway, complex numbers, super useful. But they have these really quirky behaviors when you try to draw complex numbers, you try to visualize them. And the Mandelbrot set is one example of a set of complex numbers that have this weird convergent property that basically they look like a fractal, right? Okay. So as you keep going in and zooming in to the Mandelbrot set, you just see different layers of Mandelbrot sets within it. It's kind of like a fractal is like a broccoli, right? So when you look closely at a broccoli stalk and you zoom in, what you see is a smaller broccoli stalk. You look at that small broccoli stalk and you look closer and you see another small, you know what I mean? And it kind of just continues. And so just the math itself, when you visualize it, is so... It's weird, right? Like there's one fractal called the Barnsley fern, which was named for the mathematician Michael Barnsley, and it's basically a fractal pattern that looks exactly like a fern leaf.
Okay.
And it's just weird and wacky and
another visual representation of numbers.
Of numbers, yeah, exactly. I love it. Do we have time for a quick ad?
Do we ever? Let's do it. Add me up.
Benjamin, have you ever wanted to smell a masterpiece? Don't answer, because now you can. Introducing Sensational Art, the revolutionary new way to experience art. Now, specially crafted fragrances capture the essence of famous paintings, from the sweet scent of a blossoming rose to the salty tang of a crashing wave. Imagine walking through a gallery surrounded by the intoxicating aroma of Van Gogh's flowers or the earthly scent of Monet's water lilies. It's like stepping into the paint itself. So come on down to Sensational Art and experience art like never before. Your nose will thank you.
Love it! Love it! Oh, I'm sorry to take the kind of theme in our little commercials. There's a lot of smelling involved.
Have we already done smelling? What was it? Oh, was it the smelloscope? Smelloscope. It's just another way to visualize. Great. You can visualize the science. You can smell the science.
Mm.
You can touch the science.
I have a t-shirt idea cooking. Okay.
Okay. All right. What else we got?
blah, blah, blah.
Yep, that's a fair one.
I was thinking about how, golly gee. Speaking of
ducks,
I was thinking about microscopy. And I was on vacation earlier this year and we're walking around and we're in Cancun, Mexico. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Mm-hmm. Lovely, lovely, lovely. And there are all sorts of people all over the place trying to sell all sorts of souvenirs, primarily bottles of tequila with worms in it. That's the big one. But there was one guy. He had a very different shtick altogether. They sell you this huge poster, which is either a realistic photo or a painting of a macro photography photo of your eye. You sit down in the thingamajig like you do at the optometrist, and they have your face go up against the camera, and they take this big flash, flash, flash right in your eyeball, and they take a photo. And the work that they provided was just incredibly super high definition photos. You can see everything inside your eye, the pupil, wow, the color, the cornea, the little little veins here and there. It sounds kind of creepy, but the store itself was unlike all the other stores on the strip. It was white like a gallery, and all the photos of people's eyes are on the walls. Sounds kind of creepy. But it was absolutely a colorful rainbow display of people's eyes. It was gorgeous. And I thought that is a good example of science presented as art. It was also ridiculously expensive and I didn't do it. But still, I liked it. And I looked at it and I was actually I slept there for a while. It was quite nice.
I do like that some of the best art it's microscopes and telescopes. It's just making, you know, big things from far away appear closer and little things appear bigger. Big things make them smaller, small things make them bigger. And it just gives us these additional windows into the incredible natural world around us. It's spectacular. It's really, really cool.
Right.
I think we're also getting better at making this sort of stuff synthetically. So as science gets better, and we can understand what math you need to, or what math describes the natural world around us, people are using that math to then simulate these sorts of beautiful things. Right. So if you look at something like ray tracing, right, for 3D computer graphics, for video games, for CGI, it's this ability to know the math and the way that light moves in a room around objects, and to be able to turn that, you know, you turn that into equations and you put the equations into a computer and you recreate reality in such an incredible way that it's just like, it's like a simulation, man.
Yeah, there are several video games that you can play. Flight simulators, everybody knows about. It's very strict adherence to the laws of physics to make those games work, and they're very nice. There's one game my son got and that I fell in love with called Astroneer. It's an interesting little game. It's kind of Minecraft-ish, but it follows the laws of physics. You're an astronaut, and you're running around on the surface of a planet looking for minerals and what have you. And everything is important. The atmosphere, you learn about what the atmosphere is on them, and it tells you what the molecular composition is of the atmosphere. So is the air you can use or not? But the size of the planet is, what the gravity is. It slows or speeds up your movement. You have to get different minerals. That's the point of the game. Some things weigh more than others. So you can only carry X of this, but Y of that. And you have to keep bringing it back. You have to monitor your air supply and all these other things. And you have to go from world to world to world to get different things. Each world has its own different set of parameters. And they all adhere to pretty strict rules of physics. You can't. There's one little like laser drilling gun that just drills a hole. But apart from that, everything else, there's no really fantastical tools or wild spaceships or anything like that. It's just very basic, simple.
It's just physics.
Very simple physics game, and it took off. There's a new version of it coming out, actually, too, I think. I saw when I looked this up. But very interesting game. Fun, silly, but it gives you a good sense.
I like it. It sounds fun. Mm-hmm. So we should do an episode on video games.
Oh boy! Okay.
Oh yeah. We should choose more topics that are descriptions of visual media for our for our podcast.
Well, yeah. One of my favorite video games is X-Wing versus Starfighter from LucasArts way back when, and one part that really upset me when I played that game. And I love that game. You're flying through space. What I hated about that game is when you shut off your engines, you just came to a stop. I'm like, no. No. I know it's Star Wars, but come on, man.
Isaac Newton would be spinning in his grave.
If the grave was floating in space, he would be.
Well, yeah, if he had been set in motion spinning before he was buried, because then otherwise... Yeah, so he would only stay spinning in motion if somebody had set it in motion. sorry. I think one of the other cool overlaps between science and art comes in the form of architecture, especially with like the design of environmental buildings. So you have like cool concept architecture, but there are these kind of really practical elements that we've started to discover. And like you could start, you know, like 150 years ago with Chicago and the invention of the skyscraper and our understanding of basic engineering principles that allowed us to just, you know, use steel beams and concrete and understand that walls don't have to be load bearing at all. That's why you can have skyscrapers with, you know, glass walls. But then from like the practical and the engineering side to having these buildings that you're seeing more and more these days that are designed in such a way to maximize airflow and temperature control without having, you know, some AC unit that's constantly working, constantly burning fossil fuels. There's a building like this at the University of Tel Aviv in Israel that basically has like a zero net footprint, because the flow of the air, the solar panels, everything about the structure of the building and the material it's designed from means that you never have to turn on an AC unit. The light is maximized, so you barely have to use electricity, you know, for the most part during the day. I think we're seeing more and more buildings like this. So it's not quite art, but it's architecture that is being kind of informed by scientific principles.
Yeah. Another thing that is beautiful. There's another beautiful thing that's coming as far as bridges, and they're being built, I believe, in Europe and I think we've built one in the United States. It's a nature preserve crossing bridges that go over freeways. And from a scientific point of view, there is these big, very, very wide, very gradually sloping type of land bridges that are being built to go over freeways. And there's no road on it. There's no walkway. There's no street. There's no electricity, no lights, no anything. It's just nature, earth, some trees and bushes, whatever is native to the environment. So animals have a safe way to cross the freeway. And it's a very gradual, natural thing. It looks like a hill, whatever. But if you're from the point of view of a car on the freeway, you have this gorgeous type of overly tunnel that you can go through. Very gently slide underneath nature. And it's a good looking bridge from a, you know, aesthetically pleasing point of view. But it's also serving a purpose to help nature just get around humans and humans get around nature and not really hurt each other.
It's it's a good point though, because like it is really hurt each other. It's not just that, you know, it was affecting animals' abilities to migrate and move across their natural habitat, but also when they would try to cross the road, it would not end well for them, and it would also not end well for cars that would, you know, be swerving or getting into accidents because they're trying to avoid them. So yeah, animal crossings are definitely a great way to kind of do the best for everyone, I guess. Mm-hmm. I love it. I love it. I like it a lot. Yeah. Okay. So I feel like we have gone down a path of, you know, seeing space art and science art, but I think that there's also more and more art that's moving out of these traditional realms, and you have things like auditory art, you have sonifications, and this has been such a huge part both in making science more accessible, so people who have visual impairments are able to still experience the joy and wonder of, you know, astronomy or various fields of space science through sonifications of the data. But also sonifications have been used not just for talking about modern science, but they've been used for expressing traditional science. So with the indigenous peoples in Australia, a lot of the First Nations have stories and culture that are tied to the land. They're tied to the sounds of the land. And so there are a lot of really cool projects now that are taking sonifications of different paths and different areas and are kind of packaging that as a journey that that you can enjoy, that you can experience, which I think is definitely something that's kind of getting away from us otherwise, you know, especially if you live in a big city, you're not experiencing that, right?
Totally. The absence of night is a thing. Stars are going away for the big city folk, and so is their connection to regular natural environments. Everything's not concrete and steel out there. As a matter of fact, the majority of the world isn't concrete and steel. That's a wonderful thing to help, you know, bring that richness back and let people experience it. Very, very,
sure.
Very cool. I like that.
Yeah.
I like, there is something in San Francisco, not too far from Pier 39, called the Wave Organ. And it's this great little miniature amphitheater. You can sit like maybe 12 people in it, and you sit around this little circle, and the little wall around it has all these different holes, but the holes at the other end face the tide, the bay water on the other side, and each hole is a little tunnel, a tube of different lengths. So as you're sitting there and the waves start crashing, it plays this wonderful music while you're sitting there. Not any serious notes or patterns to it, but in its chaotic noises, it makes a beautiful kind of music. It's actually very, very, it gets very loud depending on how high the tide is and how rough the water is, but it's just basically sitting in a little amphitheater of wave-made music. And it's a very nice place to go. Nice to go on a, like, for a picnic.
That is so cool. I would love to get the recordings of that and then run it through a program that can identify like key frequencies, because you could probably take those sound recordings and figure out, you know, the most dominant frequencies would be high and low tide. You pick up all sorts of like really interesting physics just by analyzing those sound files.
Okay, that's it. I don't know if, I'm sure there are recordings of it. Now I have to go find some, or at least go make some. It takes away a while to get out there. But okay, wave organ, yeah. Recording. Wave organ. Have it,
that's cool.
It. Yeah.
I will definitely try to check that out. And if folks are listening and they have other examples of cool sonifications or visual art that represents science, please send them to us. We would love to see them and share them with our other listeners and viewers. And similarly, if you're listening or watching and you have other ideas for future episodes, drop us a message. Slide into our DMs.
Yeah. Someone actually did today. I'm very excited about it. Not saying anything. Possible future guest. You guys might like it. So if you reach out to us, we might have you on the show.
Yes, indeed. I mean, that's basically how we got Janet Ivey to join us a few weeks ago. So we were very, very fortunate that Janet had reached out to us. And so,
oh, that was so fantastic. Yeah, was, I'm getting so, so much feedback from people who heard her episode. And they just keep telling us, she's amazing. She's amazing. How does she have so much energy? I'm like, I don't know. She's probably made out of coffee.
No, she's an incredible human being. And if folks haven't listened to that episode, go back and listen to it and or watch it on the YouTube or on the Tiki-Toki clock app. Where else can people find you, Benjamin?
You can find me as Science Actually on Facebook primarily, but also on Instagram and Threads and Mastodon and Hive and the Twitter and on LinkedIn. And you can find, of course, this show, all 39 of our previous episodes, and this, our 40th episode, on TikTok and YouTube and wherever you download your podcast. How about you, Kavi? Where can people find you?
I don't want them to find me. I just want to.
All right. Never mind that question.
No. People can find me at Fun Fact Science on all the social medias. You can come for the memes and stay for the science. That's my jam. this has been fun. I do love these episodes. Thank you. Thank you, Benjamin. Thank you to all of our listeners and viewers. And we will see y'all next time on Science Actually Presents The Nerd and the Scientist.
Thank you all for listening.
One trick is to tell them stories that don't go anywhere. Like the time I caught the ferry over to Shelbyville, I needed a new heel for my shoe. So I decided to go to Morganville, which is what they call Shelbyville in those days. So I tied an onion to my belt, which was the style at the time. Now, to take the ferry cost a nickel, and in those days, nickels had pictures of bumblebees on them. Give me 5 bees for a quarter, you'd say. Now, where were we? Oh, yeah. The important thing was that I had an onion on my belt, which was the style at the time. They didn't have white onions because of the war. The only thing you could get was those big yellow ones.